You're listening to The Soul Chronicles, the podcast navigating life and times in the sneaker industry, Hollywood, and corporate America.
Hi, welcome to another episode of The Soul Chronicles, the podcast navigating life and times in the sneaker, sports industries, Hollywood, and corporate America. I'm your co-host, Mohammeda El-Muhajir, along with...
Hey there, I'm Nikita Newell Hall. Thanks for joining us today. So I've known this guy for, I don't even know, many years. And I've watched him navigate the sneaker industry in a way that not many can. He has had so much longevity working for the absolute top brands in the industry in various roles. He has 20 or more years in the senior executive level, working at Nike and at Converse. Some of his skill sets are in sports marketing, strategy, planning, operations, just an all-around, well-rounded business executive who happens to be using his skills in sports. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please help me welcome to the Soul Chronicles podcast, Mr. Rick Wilson.
I started looking around to figure out who the hell else was in the room.
And that's all like, you.
I was like, yo, that's kind of, you should follow me around and like do that with me. Like when I enter a room, regardless of what I'm doing in life, you know, before I walk in, you go in and say all of that. And then I walk in. That'd be really cool.
Let me tell you something. It would be my pleasure. Absolute my pleasure. It's our pleasure. I'm going to hop right in because I know you have a very busy day today. You're juggling a dad role today and, you know, making time for us. And we're going to talk about all of that. But so you are the senior director of sports marketing at one of the premier sports brands in the world, at Nike. What does that mean, senior director of sports marketing? What do you do?
So currently, I've been at Nike for 25 years.
Wow.
And I started in sports marketing, didn't know what it was. And this is 1995. So I started at Nike in 95, didn't quite frankly know what it was. And we'll get into that, I would assume. Went through a myriad of different roles, but currently I'm working in, it feels like more of a strategy role. So Kevin Durant, Paul George, and Kobe are the three athletes. They're business silos that I work with. I'm working in strategy and sports marketing. It's kind of a hybrid, more of a business lead. I did not, Nikita, quite frankly, listening as you were speaking about some of the things that I'd done, I couldn't have done this 15 years ago because I didn't understand the functions. And I think the day-to-day that go into it, you're working with sales, you're working with inventory management, you're working with merchandising, you're working with footwear, you're working with development. And it's bringing those pieces together that say, you know, we're taking a Kevin Durant shoe to the market. We have these alignment calls and interfaces by which you have to be on the same accord to say, how many pair are we selling? What are we selling them for? How long are they going to be in the market? What should we make off of them? When we get them back, we don't want to shred them. We want to continue making, still driving revenue off those shoes. How do we do that? What does it look like in the geo? How many pair are we going to sell in China? All of that is what I do now, working within that function. And I enjoy it because I think based on the years spent, as you can see when I was telling you earlier about my long answers, based on the years spent, I've been curious about the different pieces that go into bringing the athlete to life from a product perspective. And this is the first time that I've done it to this extent. So I'm enjoying it right now.
Wow. So what I hear you saying is this is a role that you have evolved into. And that's really important because I think when you have young people who are listening to our podcast, you know, they're in college, they have decided they want a career in sports marketing. They don't really know what that means, right? They don't really know what they're going to need to be successful in that role, as well as we're in a COVID year and so much has shifted and changed. And people who are already in the workforce are looking at, what is my true passion? What kind of career shift do I want to make? And I've talked to many people who are always asking me about how they transition their career into sports marketing. So I love that you said you weren't even ready for what this was at the time when you got in, but you stuck with it. You did the work. I think you also went and sought some higher education so that you could be more astute on the business side of things, obtaining this degree. So I think it's so important for people to hear your story and to know what types of skill sets they really do need to work in some of these roles behind the scenes. So thank you for that. One thing that I was curious about is you said when you first started, you weren't really prepared for the role that you're doing now. And what did you do when you first started? What was your first role?
I went to George Mason. I played basketball at George Mason, played professional basketball out of college. And many athletes, and I say this again, many athletes are now, were then, in a very similar conundrum. By that meaning, when the basketball stopped, when the air was gone out of basketball, I think I was 29 years old, I didn't have a clue as to what I would do next. I was a communication and journalism major. When I was coming out of college, I actually wanted to go to Carnegie Mellon. I'd applied. That's what I wanted to do. And basketball kind of redirected me. So traveled that for a while. It took me to some great places. I played NBA basketball. I played international basketball. But when it stopped, I didn't know what I wanted to do. So the Nike opportunity, I think I may have inquired at Reebok first. I hope Nike people don't hear that now, but I think I inquired at Reebok first because they were pretty popular at the time. But the Nike opportunity kind of happened. And when I came on board, I was working in a function with a few other guys, and the athlete relationships or the models were very different than back then. And I may have mentioned it earlier when you and I were chatting, there was this mantra of seek, sign, and serve. And that's all you ever heard in sports marketing. Seek, sign, serve. Seek, sign, serve.
Well, Rick, let me jump in real quick, because I mean, how do you go from being an athlete to get a corporate job? I mean, you made some inquiries, but what was that like? Because you don't hear that that often. Like, well, how did that happen?
I actually was pursuing a completely different path. So I'm going to say between the time I stopped playing and started working at Nike, it was probably about 2 years, because mm-hmm. I think I actually tore my ACL. Mm-hmm. Tore my ACL, was tormented by the fact that I wouldn't play basketball anymore. And I knew a few people that I'd met through one of the key people, Howard White, mm-hmm. that I'd met over the years. And I started reaching out to them and I talked to H, et cetera. And I was like, hey, man, who else do I need to talk to? Mm-hmm. I'd also met a few people when I was playing and I was in San Antonio. We had a few athletes on a team that were Nike athletes and people from Nike would come down. Mm-hmm. So when those people would come, I just made contacts and it was shaking hands. I knew for a fact that I was going to come to this bridge or threshold in which I had to do something different. So basketball's done. I don't know what I'm doing. I worked at an insurance agency trying to figure out if I wanted to go to grad school immediately. Knew for a fact I didn't want to do that. And just started really just reaching out to Nike. So they brought me out for an interview. I got the job. And when I first started, all I was doing, quite frankly, was sitting in an office with other people, mm-hmm. and their athletes would order product, and I was getting the product to those athletes. Mm-hmm. And shortly thereafter, they started having me work with a few. I mean, this was the first thing I was doing out of the box. Mm-hmm. Shortly thereafter, and I'm saying within 6 months, because they hired me as a rep, but it was a lot more to it than I thought. I was traveling. I was working. I mean, the same year I started at Nike was the same year that Rasheed Wallace and Kevin Garnett and those guys and Joe Smith and those dudes were in the draft. And quite frankly, I was probably, again, I was like 29 and those guys were younger, but not much younger. So I started working with them. That was the entree, or that was kind of the open door to get me kind of moving in the right direction at Nike. That's what I did at the very beginning. I was working with the athletes. I was traveling a great deal, fulfilling their product needs, working with their camps. The NBA season is over. They'd say to me, hey, man, I want to have a camp in for Garnett. I want to be in South Carolina. I'm having a camp in Malden High School, I think is where he went there initially. I put his camp together. I'd go there with him. I mean, it really was day-to-day, mano-a-mano with the athletes. And that's what I did at the beginning.
Wow. So let me just pause right here and recognize a couple things. So number one, people of the world, you have not had a job interview until you interviewed to work at Nike. Like, I don't know about you, Muhammad, or you, Rick, but I had like 5 interviews.
Did you hear me skate over that? That was my first interview. No, I never, you know, it's funny you said that. I'm pretty sure that was the first, no, that was the first time I really was in a room interviewing with anyone was at
Wowzers. Yeah, yeah, sure. It's a whole situation in and of itself. So if you got through a Nike interview and got hired, kudos to you, because this is the thing.
Nikita, I think I had a summer job at Burger King after my freshman year of college, if that counts. That was probably the only other one.
This is a whole other level.
Because the interesting thing that people don't realize about athletes is that most athletes, from the time they're like 10 or 11 years old, have been doing, sometimes even early, have been doing sports nonstop. So, you know, you don't really have a chance to get those professional skills up. Definitely not any you don't have time to do internships or anything. So making that transition is not always the easiest, Rick, but you have like just made like just an amazing career of it.
Absolutely. No,
thank you. You know, yeah. It's funny too. It's like, I've learned this as well. It's really important to know what you don't know. I mean, it's really, really important to know what you don't know. And when you surround yourself with others who are sharper, and I'm sure you both have been in a room or with someone or whatever, and you go, wow, they're looking at it from a completely different perspective. And I kind of gleaned that going through those early years at Nike. It's like, I'll save the names, but I had friends who worked at different functions at Nike, and we'd sit and they'd talk to me about hitting their year end or their quarterly targets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that stuff used to go right over my head, because that wasn't the conversation that we were having in our category of sports marketing. We were talking about having the best athletes in the world, and there was an athlete that kind of came onto the radar. How do we get him? Then I'd go into another room, and those guys were going, "Hey, man, we have a merch meeting on Monday, and blah 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 about the merch meeting and the weighted margins on this are down." And this is probably my second or third year in. So in 2000, and I started in 95. So in 2000, my son was born. And that kind of changed my thoughts, really, because I'm going, wow, I don't see the growth. Not that sports marketing wasn't moving in the right way, and I've enjoyed and learned so much, but I didn't see my growth within Nike in those first couple of years on par with where I wanted to go. So prior to Nike, and I think I have worked at Nike Converse in Jordan, but prior to Nike buying Converse, I actually departed Nike and went to Converse, and those two companies were separate. Mm-hmm. Only because after speaking to people at Converse, they were like, "Hey, you can come here. You can make all the mistakes in the world, but we can move this thing forward together." And I felt like I'd be more like the pirate than the Navy. Mm-hmm. So I went there, and then Nike ended up buying Converse and rolling me back in. But back to what I was saying earlier, it was important to know what I didn't know, because I wasn't being taught that. It was like, "Hey, you have a general skill set, work with the athletes, do A, B, C, and D, and we'll do the rest." Which may have been fine if I felt A, B, C, and D was moving me into long-term growth. I didn't feel like that very early on. Doesn't mean it wouldn't have, but I think probably my own impatience led me to leave Nike for a short while and go to Converse before coming back.
Wow. There's so many things I want to ask you, but I have to keep my thoughts straight. So number one, you said something that I want to go into a little bit deeper when you talked about your role, seek, sign, and serve the athletes. I was in a similar role with the NBA, working hands-on with the athletes. And this is not to be negative, but I do want to be honest with our audience. To me, the athlete is the most important piece in this whole puzzle. Right? Without the athlete, you don't have a game. There is no game. You don't have a shoe, like not a branded shoe. And so when you're working in those functions, though, sometimes other people, and I'll use that term, other people, don't value it. They see you working with the athletes as a throwaway thing. Like, "Oh, that's just the guy who has Kevin Durant's phone number." Did you ever feel that way?
Yes, very much so. I got to be honest with you. I had conversations that were, they were held at the 30,000 foot level, so to speak, but in earshot of me sitting there, and it was expressed to me that what I did didn't contribute to the bottom line.
Wow.
And therefore my growth would be very different than those who were in revenue driving categories, blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
That is mind boggling to me. Like my head just came off my shoulder. So you're out signing guys like Durant. You're out making sure that you have the right type of relationships with them. You are building rapport with them so that they are bonded to the brand and that they want to do things. Listen, yeah, guys are getting paid to be associated with the brands. Nobody's stupid. We know that. But there's so many things above and beyond what's just in that simple contract that brands end up wanting from players mm-hmm. that they do mm-hmm. based on the strength of our relationships with them. And the fact that that is so minimized, I just can't let that go. I just can't.
I will say that with one caveat, and I'm speaking to my early years at Nike, where I felt like, okay, I was surely younger, different place in my career path, et cetera. But back then, there were different leaders in place as well, and you were different category VPs in place as well. But yeah, I've sat in a room with people, I've been in conversation with people, absolutely, where they have not said, hey, Rick, what you do, but just really with a kind of a broad brush, expressed sports marketing or basketball sports marketing and how what you do as an active participant and or leader in basketball sports marketing is very different with your peer who works in footwear, because footwear drives the engine. And footwear does have a target that they're aligning to, and you don't have that. You guys are out spending money. We make the money. You spend the money. You're hanging with the athlete. You're doing all the cool stuff, but you couldn't do that if we didn't make. Yeah, I'd be lying. I'd be remiss if I didn't say that. Yeah, absolutely. I've been in rooms where those conversations have been had. Now, again, I say that's a long time ago in my career, but yeah, that surely was a little bit of the guiding force, I think, when I wanted to do something different and learn more and kind of be in a better position to at least, mm-hmm. you know, forecast my career path.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I felt the same way when, you know, when I was at the NBA, God bless them, but working in player and talent relations, it just seems that it's like it didn't matter, although we knew it did. And so that's what prompted me to go to William Morris Agency, because I'm like, well, then I need to be on the side where the money is taking place. Yeah, I need to be in the middle of the money movement if that's the case, because otherwise I really didn't see myself elevating my career either. And that's how I ended up meeting Muhammad. So I can totally relate to that.
I would do this a lot of the time, especially if I didn't trust the person who would ask me the question, or if I didn't think they had my best interest at heart. And I'll give you an example. Different times, and I used to tell people that were in similar roles to mine when they would come on board, I'd go, never be enticed or tricked into having a conversation in which your entire conversation is you talking about the athlete. So someone could walk mm-hmm. up to me and go, hey, Rick, how's Kevin Garnett doing? And that was, Kevin Garnett was with Nike in the mid-90s. Hey, Rick, hey, how's KG? And as you stated, it would always be someone else or the other person. Rick, mm-hmm. How's KG doing? And I go, well, I'm not sure today. I haven't talked to him today. And I'd shift the conversation to something completely different. Not that it was something that was irrelevant. I just did not want them to pigeonhole me into my only conversation piece being about the athlete. And I felt
someone
that
else
I was
determining your value.
I felt so strongly that I was being moved into that box, which can be good and bad, because I've seen it when it really, really does work, and it works often. But, and I'm not saying something here that many aren't aware of. And when I say complacency, I'm not saying that as a negative, but in sports marketing and in those roles in which you're working with the athletes, blah, 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 because you're building long lasting relationships for the most part in some of those hand to hand roles. Well, if you're building long lasting relationships, guess what? You're going to be in that job for a long time. So if you're in that job for a long time, there's going to be minimal movement. And if there's minimal movement, the other person who just came on and wants your role or something like that probably is never going to have it until you're done. So there's not a lot of, because Nike so strongly, and I think some of the other competitive brands as well, if they're following the blueprint, it is Nike. I think because they so strongly endear and hold themselves to these relationships, there's not a whole lot of movement in those roles in sports marketing. So for me, I kind of felt that, and I was like, hey, to get the growth I need both professionally and mentally, I'm probably going to have to move around a bit.
Wow. I love that. That brings me to another question. I know you reside in Portland and you've been living in Portland for quite a long time, probably ever since I've known you. And I'm wondering what that is like for you, not only right now, but just historically what that's been like for you. You know, let me tell you, I started traveling to Beaverton for my job. I would go once a week. And Muhammad, I think you would travel to Beaverton from time to time as well. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, I never felt comfortable there. I mean, I just didn't feel welcoming to me. I felt scared. There's some cities in America where I just am like, ugh, this does not feel safe and good to me. And I would always make it a point too. You know, it's a 2-hour flight from LA to Beaverton, and I would never spend the night. I don't care how late my meetings ran. I would get on a plane, train, or automobile to get out of Portland before nightfall. You know, I just wanted to get out of there. And there was one particular time where I brought Flex Alexander to campus, and he had a show on call. I think it was One-on-One or One-to-One or something like that. It was a really popular show. He was known throughout the industry as being a really incredible stand-up guy, still is to this day. And I was driving him from the employee store to campus for his appearance, and we got pulled over by the police. And I was scared out of my mind. I'm like, this guy doesn't know that I'm an executive at Nike. He doesn't know that Flex is a star in his own right and a really incredible guy. I'm scared he's going to see two Black people in a very shiny, expensive car. And I did not know what to do. And it was Flex talking me through that. And I'd never been pulled over by the police. I, of course, growing up, I know the issues and that are very real, not made up. And so I was just dying. And it was Flex talking me through it, like, okay, calm down, just relax. You know, go ahead and get your ID out. He's going to want to see your driver's license. Just be cool. We're going to be okay. And it was so traumatic, and it was fine. He wrote me a ticket. I pulled into the bike lane or some random thing. I don't even know. And we went on, but I was shaking all the way to campus. And I'll never forget that feeling. And nothing bad happened. Let me just say that. Nothing bad happened. But it just was a very uncomfortable place for me. So I want to know, how has Portland been for you and for your family?
I guess there's a couple pieces here. So when I first moved to Portland, I was 29, I think. And to be honest with you, I was traveling so much that Portland never really, I mean, I was single. I was traveling a great deal. I'm born and raised in Virginia. And then at the time going back and forth to Maryland, I had a place in Maryland. So Portland never felt like home when I first started. I was going back and forth a great deal. And so Carmen and I met in 95. We got married in 2000. And then shortly thereafter, I took the role at Converse. And we moved there with a 1-year-old son to Boston. So I was in Boston for 2 years. So I went, took the job at Portland, moved to Boston, moved to Maryland, then back to Portland. We just moved back to Portland 6 years ago. So we spent actually about 14 years on the East Coast, 2 in Boston and 12 in Maryland before coming back to Portland in 2014. Now, when I moved back, my son was 14 because he was born in 2000 and my daughter was 12. It felt very different to me then versus when I started. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. When I was there earlier, the first time, I didn't really care about incongruencies in the community or whatever. I couldn't have told you who was in office. I didn't know who was running for mayor. I mean, I didn't have a reason to be concerned about none of that. And I was immune to what was going on, quite frankly, in Portland. So you just gave the example of with yourself and Flex. That happened to me in Boston. The only difference was mine ended in incarceration and I was in a jail all day and blah, 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 blah. I mean, it was one of the worst experiences in my professional career. And oddly, as you relate your experience in going to the employee store, coming from the employee store, I was in a suit driving into work at Converse in Boston. And it's a long story, but I was in a suit driving to work, just pulled out of this temporary housing that Carmen and I were staying in. I didn't even get to the stop sign. And an officer pulled me over and he was asking me all kinds of questions that weren't related. Long story short, I wouldn't get out of the car. They called more police officers. They arrested me. They put handcuffs on my hands and on my feet.
Oh, God, Rick.
What? No, seriously. They took me to Woburn County Jail, which isn't even the county I was in. And I was in and Carmen had to bring my son, who was maybe 1 at the time, to come to the arraignment so that I could get released. I mean, and at that point she was like, I'm not living in Boston. And then we moved to Maryland. Mm. So when you talk about Portland, as you're saying Portland, I would, for me, that Portland, I don't feel like that in Portland. I know a lot of people in Portland. I do stay in my pockets, no doubt about it. Moving back out there, moving there from Maryland, I was more concerned with being in Maryland, with the kids being in public school. And there's a level of safety in Maryland that I didn't have to deal with in Portland. I didn't feel like that. Now, fast forward to right now in 2020, I don't feel like I want to be there. I mean, I'm in Maryland right now. Carmen's in LA right now. I got to go back for a second and we're coming back to the East Coast because there's there's so much going on in downtown Portland right now that I don't want to be there. And before, you know, my daughter's incoming freshman at Hampton, she was waking up at 5 a.m. to do the eight o'clock virtual classrooms or virtual calls or whatever. But with her being in Portland right now, I'm like, well, where should she be? Where should she not be? She's driving. She's in the car by herself. They got all these different factions, and I use that word loosely, of what's going on in Portland. And I'm just like, hey, baby, let's do this. Why don't we just take you to the East Coast and you stay there until school starts at Hampton? So I do feel very uncomfortable in certain areas in Portland right now. I didn't feel like that before. I mean, my son, who was probably more introverted than extrovert when we moved to Portland 6 years ago, has gone through an amazing kind of maturing, if you will, and having been in Portland. I mean, you know, so I'm blessed to be able to say that. Where I wasn't sure if he was, you know, going to go through that in Maryland, because Maryland's a different place. But I don't feel threatened, and I don't feel any of that, or didn't feel threatened at all. Right now, when I'm in Portland, I'd stay pretty close to my neighborhood. Nike's obviously going under the shutdown from COVID, so we're not in the office. It's all work from home. But every day you turn the news on, there's a lot of unrest, I would say, downtown in Portland, so I stay away from it. So right now, yeah, I have the concerns, but being a Black male in Portland, Oregon, I've never been overly concerned about that. And I will add to that, I've been pulled over as well for no other reason than I have a nicer car than I should have. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. And I get pulled over. That's happened to me. But it's happened to me everywhere else too, so I don't feel any different.
Right.
I mean, I can't say, you know, Portland is not some outlier where I feel like it's happened in Portland, and this wouldn't have happened if I was in Massachusetts, because it's happened when I've been in Maryland, and I was born in Virginia, and it's happened there. So everywhere that I've lived, it's happened. So nothing's happened to Portland that I felt like would not have gone down anyplace else. The times that I think that those episodes have exceeded what probably would have happened in Portland was the example I gave you in Massachusetts, which is not some place I'd be really fond of living right now.
Yeah, Boston was tricky for sure. So one last thing that I want to touch on before we let you go. I know our time is short here. You talked a lot about your son and your daughter and about Carmen. And wait, can we just, you know, I always have to take a pause for a minute, time out. Can we shout out Carmen Wilson right now, ladies and gentlemen? Can we give it up one time?
My son is clapping too.
Yes. I mean, this is about you, Rick, so I don't want to take your shine at all. But I have to tell you, you married the most incredible woman in the world. Like, I don't know what you did to get that kind of favor, but you got it. And she's one of my favorite people. Always the same every time you see her. Her heart is so pure. So I have to shout out Carmen. She's been so instrumental in my career and in my life as a friend. So I definitely want to acknowledge her publicly. A lot of what I hear coming through is you talking about this balance, you know, fatherhood, being a sports executive, you know, being a husband, being a Black man in America. You know, there's some balance going on there. There's a balance in that. And before I started to look into this interview with you, I hadn't really considered about the balancing and the juggling act that men do. I usually equate that with women. They're juggling motherhood. They're trying to be a good wife. They're trying to, you know, work all day, whatever. But it sounds to me like you do a lot of juggling between balancing all these roles. How do you do it?
That's a really good question, too. When we were, so I'm going to go backwards first to give you kind of more context. When we were living in Boston, after the episode in Boston, we moved to Maryland. And Converse had an office in Maryland that was shared space with the Jordan brand and Nike. It was off of 17 in Pennsylvania. And I worked out of that space for a while. After a short while, which might have been 2006 or seven, somewhere. No, it was later than that, Nikita, sorry. Might have been 2008 or nine. They closed that space. So between there and the time, so from it was from there to 2012, they were saying that I needed to move back to Boston, to which Carmen was like, I'm not doing that. And obviously she was doing her own thing and working on different projects, et cetera. And she was like, Rick, I don't want to go back. And my son was 9 years old. My daughter was like seven. So I'm going, I got to figure out a way to make this work. And this is really amazing. So I had a few friends who were like, hey, dude, I have a friend who can give you a buddy pass. I'm like, what are you talking about? They were like, yeah, we'll give you a buddy pass and you can fly up to Boston every single week. Just get an apartment in Boston. So I bought another car. I drove it to Boston, kept it at a friend's house. And from the very beginning, to go back in Maryland, because my son was taking karate. I put him in karate. He was like, oh, I don't really want to do that. And I told him, I said, each time you have karate practice, I'm going to go. Mind you, I'm going back and forth from Boston. So I would fly. I would be home on Fridays, on Saturday, Sunday. On Monday morning, I would fly to Boston. I'd be in Boston Monday, Tuesday. I'd fly back Tuesday night. I'd fly back Tuesday night. I'd be home all day Wednesday because he had karate practice. I'd go back Thursday morning. I'd be in Boston Thursday, Friday. I'd come back Friday night, be home Friday, Saturday, Sunday, go back Monday morning. I did that for almost 3 years.
Wow.
Every week. I mean, I was taking 4 flights a week. Now, mind you, they're only about 50 minutes from BWI to Logan Airport. But I was flying up, flying back, flying up, flying back. More than anything else, because first and foremost, I didn't want to be in a place in which I didn't feel unilaterally accepted. And that's not how I felt when I was in Massachusetts. That's one. Two, my wife was like, I don't want to live there. Three, I did not want my kids to be in a place in which I didn't think they would accept my children. And that's just kind of how I felt because I'd experienced it. So rather than move them, I told Carmen, I said, we'll go back and forth. I'll go back and forth for as much as I possibly can. I did that for 3 years up until 2012. And at that point, it was just like, it's wearing on my home and it's wearing on our relationship and something had to give. So I was like, hey, I'm going to step down. And I did at Converse and I went to grad school at Strayer. I started taking classes immediately. I was like, I got to have something to do. And while I was in grad school, I was still communicating with people at Nike that were in senior leadership. And as it got close to me finishing that, they were like, hey, what's your interest in coming back to Nike? And that's when I went and took the role at Jordan. But I've always been really good at kind of keeping those lines of communication open. I think, and I say this to young people now when I speak to them, I think it's important that you have a board. This is what I do know. I don't have all the answers, but there's 4 or 5 people that I speak to on a regular basis that are more senior than myself in many ways. And if I have to make a big decision, I'll run it by them. So go back to 2012, I was actually like, you know what? I should probably do something different. Talk to 4 or 5 different individuals who I knew for a fact could speak to me from a very objective point of view and just look at the decision and say, what's next? So in conversation with some of these individuals was why I went back to Nike, but I don't do a whole lot without kind of running it by someone else because I'm not stupid enough to think I'm the smartest person in the room. Sometimes maybe, all the times not. Mm-hmm. So having those conversations has been critical for me. And I'll say this as well. I don't think when you and I talked, and I might be jumping into something that you were going to ask me, but for young people that are coming into Nike or any other ancillary company or competitive brand, whatever it may be, I think it's important that you find others that are on the path or have been on the path that you want to be on and let them be your guiding light. I mean, versus, okay, you know what? I tell my daughter this, who's 18. I swear to you both, she thinks she has all the answers. All of them, not some.
All.
All of the answers.
We understand. We understand. Yes.
All of the answers. I don't care what I say. For some reason, as I'm saying it and I look in her eyes, I'm going, she don't believe a word I'm saying. Or she hears it and believes it and says, I'm not going to do any of it. I keep trying to convince her. I told her this one time, and I'll be really quick with this. I told her this one time. When we were living in Maryland, every time we would come home, I'd pull into the garage. My son was like 5 or 6, and she was like 4, or whatever. I'd pull into the garage. And they would not go into the house until I went into the house through the garage door and turned the lights on. They just wouldn't. They were scared to death of going in the house when it was dark. They just would not go inside. So as she got older, I was trying to get a point across to her. And I said, you know what? I said, every time I tell you something, you want to do something different. For some reason, you feel like I've not experienced it. And I'm telling you something that's wrong. I go, but I'm trying to help you understand things you don't understand. She's like, what do you mean? I go, just like when you were a kid and we come home and you didn't want to go in the house when the house was dark. And I'd have to go open the garage door, turn the lights on, turn the alarm off. Then you and your brother would come into the house. Do you remember that? She goes, yeah. It's the same thing now. You don't know anything about what's going on in this world. It's darkness to you. And from a point of knowledge, I'm trying to turn on the lights. Let me turn on the lights and stop trying to travel down these paths by which you want to learn from your own mistakes. I don't want you to skin your knees. I want to turn the lights on for you so that you know based on what I'm telling you, not trial and error.
Wow.
So you don't talk to her from those. My son different, but if I don't talk to my daughter from that perspective, it's going to go right over her head.
So thank you, Rick. You've been dropping some nuggets from your professional life, personal life. We appreciate it. As you know, this podcast is called The Soul Chronicles. So we love stories, right? Nikita and I talk a lot about stories, experiences that we've had with athletes and celebrities as it relates to our careers. And I mean, you have worked with some of the biggest names in sports. I'd love to hear some of your highlights. You mentioned you worked with Kobe. I mean, just any just a highlight that you love, that something that has happened that you're like, I love my work. Has any experiences like that?
It's funny. Nikita, you may be very familiar, or Muhammad, you might be as well. And I can't recall kind of where you're, when you guys were at Nike, or you, well, you weren't there at this time, I don't think, but you may remember. But two things. One, I think when I went to Converse, because I kind of like to get my hands in the weeds a little bit, it was really fun to go there. And there were no athletes. There was none. And the everyone was kind of like concentrating on LeBron and Carmelo in that 2003 draft. And because people were kind of looking really kind of transfixed with those two individuals, it was really cool for me. And I didn't have anyone else. It was just me. So it was really kind of cool to compile a list of athletes, one of them being, or the leader of those athletes being Dwayne Wade. So in 2003, Dwayne Wade coming to Converse and being able to drive, and quite frankly, that was where a lot of the learning started, being able to drive revenue against signature footwear for him. We had five athletes out of that 03 draft, and it was Wade, Chris Bosh, Mike Sweetney, Kirk Heinrich, and Troy Bell from Boston College. That was really fun for me because I could really take a swing and be judged based on my hit or misses. That shines pretty great for me. And to have now built over 17 years a very, very good relationship with Dwayne. And I'd like to say that I have many great relationships, but that's one that I've really kind of appreciated and nurtured over the years. From a Nike perspective, I really, really was blown away to work with Kobe, obviously before his passing, because I'm a huge Kobe fan. But in the mid-90s, Nike did a campaign called The Fun Police. And don't ask me why. It just sticks with me. I really loved working with The Fun Police. Gary Payton was in it. KG was in it. Damon Stoudemire was in it. That was really, really fun because Alonzo Mourning was in it. You're working with the athletes every single day. We were actually filming episodes of The Fun Police around the timetable by which the OJ trial was going on. I've been there for a long time, so there's so many different things I think that kind of ring the bell, and I surely appreciate them all.
Okay, yeah. So thank you. And I worked at Nike from 99 to 2003. So some of that happened during that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, Nike's a very different company now. Obviously, they've gotten closer to the consumer. They kind of chart their business very differently. It felt more hands-on then than it is right now. Obviously, the word digital did not exist, Muhammad, in 1999. I don't think so. I'll tell you something that was really funny. When I first started working there, this is really funny. When I first started working at Nike in 95, this girl named Julie English, she sat in sports marketing and she asked me what I needed. And she was Peter Rupi's admin. She hears this. I don't know if she remembers this, but she was Peter Rupi's admin. And she asked me what I needed and blah, 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 blah. And I really, really kind of like talked my way into the interview and landing the opportunity, et cetera. But I'll never forget this. When I first started there, they gave me, they logged on, came over, gave me my password, et cetera, et cetera. And I was asking her for different things. And then she said something like, I'm making this up for the hypothetical. Muhammad has sent you an email. You got to respond to her to get A, B, C, and D. And I was sitting at my desk going, damn, an email. So what's the email again? I had never.
Wow.
Never. I had never heard the word email. And I'm sitting there going, and I can't get up and ask anyone because clearly they know what email is. I just don't know what email is, right? And I couldn't for the life of me figure out how to get my answers without telling her, I don't know what the hell an email is, because that wasn't how people were communicating prior to me coming to Nike. And before I came to Nike in 95, I'd never sent an email. I don't know what, like, that was like an email. What the hell is that? Like, you know, so clearly a different point in my life now and it's a different company that we work with at Nike, but that's where I started from when I started there. It was that raw for me, really. Nothing about the company. All I knew for a fact was that I loved basketball. I knew I enjoyed good communication. I was negotiating contracts after a while, and I think others saw that I clearly had some level of persuasion. That, you know, I had a passion for it. And I think if you have a passion for something, you'll find within it kind of your safe haven or your space. And that's kind of what I did in sports marketing.
Wow. Thanks, Rick. Thank you.
Peter and if you guys decide, if you guys decide to send me an email now, I do know what it is.
Okay, Rick, we've come a long way. I think we all have, really. So, yes. We know you got to go, so we're going to let you go. But one thing I just want to touch on, Nikita and I talk a lot about our personalities because we serve as the representatives for Nike. People hear the word Nike or Converse or whatever, but that's the name of a company. For your athletes that you work with, you represent Nike, Jordan, Converse, right? So it's your personality. It's somehow the way that you connect with these young Black men who are like, you understand everything about them and you represent the brand. I just wanted to hear as we close out, what are your thoughts about that? Like you representing the brand and your personality and how that has really kind of enhanced the work that you do.
That is such a good question. When I started in the Bo Jackson Center, and I mean week one, when I started after you go through the onboarding and stuff like that, they're over in the Bo Jackson Center, Muhammad. There was a tattoo artist set up, and they were giving people tattoos of a swoosh on the back of their calf.
Wait, you got a Nike tattoo?
No.
Okay. Oh, I was about to say.
My point.
Okay.
But they were giving. I mean, it was after the onboarding or whatever it was called back then. But we walked over to the Bo Jackson, and then you get a tattoo. And they were getting them in a very common space, which seemed to be at the time on the back of their left or right calf. And I remember having the conversation like, hey, you know what? Guess what? I'm never going to do that because I'm not going to be here forever. That was 25 years ago. I've also fast forward had conversations with people along the way. You both have met individuals as such, by which I'm going to describe, where you meet them and you're like, Nike's who they are, not what they do, right? There's that individual. I'm never that individual for any company. Nike's what I do, not who I am. So
one of my favorite
athletes, I'm not saying he's the best ever. One of my favorite athletes of all time was, and is still, Rasheed Wallace. When I first started working at Nike, Rasheed Wallace was going through a custody dispute for his, I don't know if it was his oldest son or not, but when I first met him, in many of my conversations, he was talking to me about this custody dispute that he was having with his son's mother. And again, I think he's, safely I'd say he has four, but I know, you know, boys, but, and I don't know if it was his oldest son, but he was going through that. So the more I talked to him, the better I got to know him. So early years at Nike, I spent a lot of time at Rasheed's house, and there was this huge kind of like difference between the on-court Rasheed Wallace and the off-court Rasheed Wallace. And I endeared myself to him. I think he endeared himself to me because he knew that I wasn't living Nike through this lens by which Nike's who I am. It just happened to be a job that I had. It's like any other thing you do in your life. Like right now, I'm renting this job. And when I'm gone, someone else is going to come. And it's like an apartment. I just happen to be living in that apartment right now. It's not mine. And I feel the same way about the job. But sometimes that line of demarcation between the job and who you are gets really gray. And it ain't gray with me. I'm blessed to have had the opportunity that I've, since I've been at Nike, the growth that I've had, the people I've worked with and met, et cetera. But it's just what I happen to do right now.
Rick, we feel you on that. I mean, I'm sure that has had an impact on your success. That's definitely how Nikita and I feel about these jobs. People hear them every time I see people now. They're like, why would you leave X company? I'm like, I've been fly before I worked there, during and after. The job doesn't make me, you know what I mean? So I'm just love to hear you saying, especially somebody who you had such a long career at these companies. So
When I went to, it's the same, right? Based on the years that you've been there, you have to know that you're going to have these ebb and flows, and there are going to be certain times where you go, do I want to be here any longer? And my son is a sophomore year at a school, George Mason on the East Coast. My daughter's at Hamp University. I'm on the West Coast. So you kind of go through those, hey, Carmen, what are we doing? Blah, blah, blah. And you have those, et cetera. I get it. But at no point along the way do I sit there and go, this place is who I am. It is, it's just not. It's just, it happens to be what I'm doing right now. And I don't define myself by it.
Wow.
But I will say this as well, and it's happened to me over the years, as I've met different people or conversed with different people at Nike when I have conversations very similar to what you were just stating. I'm like, oh yeah, no, I'm thinking about what's next. And like, why would you leave Nike? I usually deflect it, because if you're asking me that, surely from a mindset, we're of a different ilk, and I'm not going to have the conversation.
Right, right, right. Wow, Rick. Oh my gosh. Thank you so much. It was just such a real honor to have you.
Oh, thank you guys.
We really want to kind of like share the stories. People, they don't know what happens behind the scenes. They don't know what the experience is like for, you know, people of color, Black people working in these industries. And we just kind of really kind of want to highlight and shed light on the personalities and the people who are making it happen. So we really appreciate you sharing your soul chronicles.
Thank you guys.
Yes, yes. Nikita, you want to add anything?
No, I just want to say thank you so much, Rick, to you and to the family for taking time out of your day to chat with us. Our hope and our prayers that somebody's going to hear this and they're going to be encouraged. They're going to be inspired. They're going to know that, A, they're not alone in these industries.
Yeah.
And the younger people are going to know, okay, this is something that I can do. This is a career path that I can take. And so if that happens, then I consider it to be successful. So one love to you and the fam. And thank you.
Likewise. Both of you. It's good to hear your voices. And as you can see, I'm a talker, so.
Right. No, that's great. That's
wonderful. That's what we want.
You ask me one question, you get 5 minutes. You're like, damn, I can get to my other questions.
No, Rick.
All right. Look, you might be our first guest where we have 2 episodes.
I think it'll be so good.
I told you, Rick Wilson is the absolute truth. And to me, he's one of the unsung heroes in this industry. Muhammad, guys like him who've been in the trenches, and who've been able to preserve these relationships with the athletes, and who are so incredibly freaking brilliant. It's the brilliance of these people that I really want to highlight and spotlight. It's not just that they're good at relationships. You see what I'm saying? Like, to me,
inner, like how I talk with you about how the connection that you have with these people, like that's what somebody like Rick Wilson has. Like, people understand that people are like, LeBron signed to Nike, or Dwayne Wade signed to Converse. No,
they signed to Rick.
To the person, right?
They signed to Rick Wilson.
Rick Wilson. They have felt the connection that's so strong, they can't explain it. It's something that they felt. I mean, of course, sometimes it's the, you know, the check, the number of zeros behind it, but many times it's the person, that relationship.
It is, Muhammad, because let me just tell you this. In the grand scheme of things, An athlete wants product endorsements, period, the end. He'll do Burger King, he'll do McDonald's, he'll do Wendy's, he'll do Arby's. He, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's what he wants. And if you're at a high enough status, most people are going to rise to the occasion with the money. Let's be real. These people are out here in the trenches. They're bumping elbows. You think Reebok don't have a checkbook? Yes, they do. What is the point of difference? What is the point of difference? To have a guy say, you know, I'm not even talking to Adidas no more. I heard the Adidas guy, you know, I've heard stories of guys who they've been offered more money.
Right.
But no, I want to be over here with this guy because why? I know this guy is going to take care of me. Mm-hmm. I know this guy's going to have my best interest at heart. And that's why I wanted to bring forward the point of these roles are as important as any role. You talk about revenue generation. What do you even say? There is no revenue to generate if Jordan doesn't sign because of H. White, mm-hmm. or if H. White doesn't steward Jordan properly to keep him connected to the brand.
That would have changed the trajectory of the history of the brand. I mean, the bottom line, the revenue, all that, you know what I mean? If guys like H. didn't have that kind of connection with the athletes. So that's just kind of crazy for people to dismiss the relevance of these kinds of roles.
And I think, and unfortunately, and I don't want to be this person, but I'm just going to tell you my truth. I do think it has a lot to do with race.
I do think
it has a lot to do with, I told you my story about something really exciting I had happened with President Barack Obama. And I promise you, people act like I knew him. I'm like, I didn't know him. I implemented a strategy. I happened to know the right people. I got on my knees and prayed, and then it happened. but I don't have Barack Obama on speed dial because we're both Black. Mm-hmm. There's strategy involved. And so that's, you know, I know I'm on my soapbox right now, but that's why I wanted to bring Rick on.
Yeah.
Because they do deserve the spotlight and they do deserve to tell their story so that, like he said, he's renting this role right now. But if he doesn't tell his story right here, where would he have told it? I'll wait. I feel good. You know, I always feel great when I have that sort of release feeling.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like, okay, we did what we came to do here. So I definitely feel released.
Yeah. Another thing I think is just important is that it's not that many people who are just as comfortable in the hood as they are in the boardroom, right? I mean, when he's like, I'm at Rasheed Wallace's house, you don't know, like that could be, I don't know, before they sign, it could be still in North Philly somewhere. I mean, and then you gotta be at Nike headquarters. Like, you know, you gotta be able to flow and feel equally as comfortable in both spaces. So it's like, that's like such a rare trait because we know a lot of people who maybe are very good professionally and, you know, doing what they do in corporate America, right? But as a Black professional, you got to be able to switch it on, switch it off, roll through the hood, roll through the VIP, and then roll through the board meeting on Monday, right? It's like...
Well, yeah. I mean, you and I used to live that world all the time, particularly when we worked in music. I mean, we'd be at the Source Awards all night. That, Nike don't care. They got a 9 a.m. staff meeting.
Right.
Don't nobody care that you got home at 3 a.m. because you were rubbing elbows for the greater good of the brand.
That was a shootout.
Nobody care. All they know is at 9 a.m. and it wasn't no Zoom then. It wasn't no phone at the end, right? You have your body fresh and proper and ready to engage in the business function. Yeah. So you do have to wear these multiple hats and to be able to function and flow effectively in all these different roles. No doubt about it. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, wow. So another great episode. I'm so glad we were able to have Rick on, you know, just such a high level person within the sports and the sneaker industry, you know, just to kind of share his story and his experience. So I think it was a great episode, Nikita.
It was so wonderful, Mohammeda. And again, you know, I'm so glad to be on this journey with you, continuing to share all of our highlights and tidbits from our life and times working in the sneaker industry and corporate America, Hollywood, and sports.
Yeah. So thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Be sure to follow us on social media at The Soul Chronicles. And then definitely send us a message if you have questions, if you have comments, feedback. We love getting feedback. And of course, if you'd like to support The Soul Chronicles with a donation to help in the production, that's always well received and appreciated. And you can do that right here on the Anchor website if you are listening here. So please definitely tune in to the next episode. I'm sure it'll be an exciting one. I don't know who's coming up next, but definitely tune in to The Soul Chronicles and we'll see you next time.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Soul Chronicles, the podcast navigating life and times in the sneaker industry, Hollywood, and corporate America. Be sure to join us for another exciting episode.